Session number 14982, Mr. J. Brown, reel 25, the last.
Brown, reel 25. You were talking of reaching home, Mr. Brown, and the difficulty of settling in after being away so long and in this difficult conditions.
The first settling in period is pretty easy, like. I mean, there's excitement on all sides, you know. You're home, this, that, and the other. The first thing is enjoy yourself, try and make up for lost time. You think in your own small mind, that's the answer, like. Get out and drinking and every night, every afternoon, all this, you know. And actually, it varied according to your service. But in our particular case, we've got 15 weeks leave. You had 15 weeks leave. They sent you your pay book, which you could draw at the local post office, you see. And then you didn't get your war credits, sir. No, not you were demobbed. That's right. But they sent you pay. You could draw your pay each week and such as that. And if you had any problems army-wise in the meantime, you could go to Brunswick Camp. That was a DLI depot at Brunswick Castle. You know, the camp was adjacent to the castle. And they were using the castle at the time. Well, I'd lost a tooth. I'd lost a front tooth there with a bit carry on. So I went through there and I got a partial set of dentures. They were very good. Straight away, pulled the old stump out. Measured us up, you know, at the... No time at all. Within a week, they fixed us up. That was good. But in the meantime, where you're living a high-pitched family life, you know, drinking and such as that, and getting round, making your relations at Langley Park and here and there, this, that, and the other. The blokes were coming back, you met in the pubs. There, where were you and all this, you know, and more drinks and such as that. And this sort of thing went on, you know. And even then, you didn't look to the future, you know. You weren't looking to the future. And I possibly made the biggest mistake I ever made in my life. But those blokes had come home before us, older lads, and they'd went away and they'd got demobbed, and they were back on Civvy Street proper, you know. And it's the way of the form. Anyway, got orders to go back to High Wycombe in Buckinghamshire, and Hazelmere Park Camp. Just about a mile and a half up the bank outside High Wycombe in Buckinghamshire. And it was a proper hooded camp. It had been a training depot for the 2nd 5th Welsh Regiment, you see. And they were accepting ex-prisoners from all over the, you know, the real the camps doing it. But anyway, got back there and anyway, if that was a waste of time, it was that like. That sergeant's quarters, we were in the sergeant's quarters, like, and there were... Nissenuts and such as that, you know, and quite comfortable. You got fed twice a day, wasn't bad. And there was a main gate with a guard hut, and unless you were on guard, when that guard was absolute bloody waste of time, a waste of 100% waste of time. But if you weren't on guard duty, there was a roll call 8 o'clock in the morning, and there wasn't another one at 8 o'clock next morning. And High Wycombe, they'd had a good influx of British soldiers. American Air Force, the 8th Air Force headquarters was just a few miles up the other side on the high ground. The Yanks had had run of the place. And to put it bluntly, you never seen as many loose women in your bloody life, God almighty. There was kind of few little pubs, it was something like that, a pub every 5 yards, you know. So, everybody by that time, you were getting your wartime credits, you know. You see, didn't amount to a lot, but it was money like. A lot of them had been prisoners, had the back money, you see, because your money went into credit while you were a prisoner of war. Well, while I was in, I'd sent a kind of bit of money home, mind. You could do that through British Red Cross. And I got a letter from a wife confirming that she'd received it and such as that, you see. So the burden hands were towing the bush like, so I was sending half at home most of the time, which I think was sensible like. And, well, the blokes were really living it up in this High Wycombe, you know. It was another bows and arches and one very thing and another. Well, I've got to say honestly, the Americans weren't looking for trouble, you know. They weren't looking for trouble, but outlooks was like, see. That's some rough bows. So at the finish, there was a right good, we all got together, get a right bloody rest, dressing down off this major, and tell us this, that, and the other. So they allocated three pubs. One was called the Falcon. It was the biggest pub, the most popular one. They allocated three pubs to the Americans. And all the rest was British. Of course, the first night, the Falcon was full of all bloody lot. See what I mean? Well, discipline point of view, the American military police, they're all 10 foot high, like, and I've got a big stick, like, I've got to be fair to them. Straight away, the trouble started. The bloody high street was pulling, knocking each other all over the place. It was all a bit, it was great. And come the jeeps, really, knocking, and do you know what they were doing? They were grabbing old blokes and giving you a backhand and kick you up the ass down the alleyway. They're giving the older blokes, they're giving them a stroke, throwing them down to one side and taking the pay box out so they know who they were. It was totally unfair, you know, the whole lot was to blame. Aye. That's what they were doing. They were whacking the one blokes out of the nose, mind. See? They'd settle down a bit, like, after that. But then decided they weren't to put you. Start to break you up again. They went not far away into Hertfordshire. And there was another camp. It had been training the Warwickshire Regiment. It was another nisnut lark. And what we were doing there, they bugger knows. But getting 2 miles a day, took you down into the village come town, Berkhamsted. I think Berkhamsted. It was a bit, peacetime, a bit snowy, I think, you know. You could get a drink and sit. And they used to run dances in the little village hall and such as that, if you wanted to go to the dance site. Used to get trucks would take you down there on the night and take you back. The next year there was knee parades and out, you know. There 2 or 3 weeks and then fuel was off went again. You got your travel warrants, had to go to London, had to go to get off at Tiverton Junction in Norfolk. And it had been a Yankee airfield and they'd left to go to the continent when the war developed and the RAF had took it over. Well, there was about 30 of us sent there. There was 2 Nissanuts, and the longest runways you ever saw in your life, you know. And, right away at the end of each runway, there would be a few Nissanuts where the Yankee crews had been stopping in. And over there, there'd be some more. And all you had to do, they'd give you a bike each. And twice a day, you had to ride round there to see all this, everything was all right. Well, these days, the white boys have been there, been wagons with loaded everything gone. I mean, there was only, they just jumped out the bunks when they went to Germany and left everything. Photos and young lasses on the wall, which everybody did and all that. The blankets were just thrown back. There was nothing of real value, you know, but this, that, and the other. So that was our job going around there then. Twice a week, you get two or three plane loads of RAF, bringing lads from Germany that had, for leave, that had been called up later on, they were due to get leave. Well, they used to be calling us, well, you want to get over there and get some bloody service in, you know. We don't like it over there. The language, you know. That sort of thing happens all the time. And then in between you filling the time in, you know, there was... The trains were running through pretty regularly. You could get down into Norwich, where Norwich was bloody packed. Americans, British, Navy, and all the lot. There's plenty of pubs, you could get drunk. There never was any trouble down there, mind, you know. But there was a hell of a big naffy there. And it wasn't open to the Americans. But you'd get your food cheap and everything, so it paid you to go there. The little bits of coffee that were selling egg and chips and this, that, and the other, oh, they were stripping their bianks, something bloody awful. They were. We went in one, but three of us, I think, went in. Why, I'm talking about prices, don't you? You get a meal for about a shilling in the British restaurant, so there was about 14 and sixpence, I think, for a, what's this? That's a very wooden pit. The bloody hell, Lord. No, I wouldn't pay it. The Americans were paying it, like, see? That's their rate of pay. But anyway, the manager come along, and he knew he wasn't going to get it, so he dropped it down to about half a crown or something. he wasn't getting paid no bloody way. And the bars was all full, it was a usual thing, you know. And then, anyway, we're going down there most of the night, I got sick of it. There's one night, I looked at the map, and there's little villages all over. There was a bloody village only 2 or 3 mile away a side road, and that was map really like. And I say, I had a bike apiece, leaving a lamp on the bike. Set off on my own this night, I said, no, I'm not going to Norwich, I'm sick to death of the bugger. And off the others went. And down to find this little village, blackout still on, you know, I mean, that need straight lamps. Find a pub, went in the pub. I'll never forget, there's 7 in the pub, you know, locals, mostly stayed in there, the landlord there. I went up, I said, I'll have a pint of bitter, please, have you got any bitter? Up my pint of bitter, no book of smoke. Not one spoke, mind. I think they must have been sick to death of the war, with Yanks and every bugger, this, that, and the other. So I had another pint, the conversation. I went, I got them in for the lot. Believe it or not, I'm sitting there, and I've got no conversation. I was disgusted. I thought to me bloody self, he's England like. I mean, generally, they'll just walk when you got the drinks in. So I got on the bloody bike, and I went back, sick. And then I had to get another medical. Demob was coming up. I was going to be demobbed on the 12th of December. I was one of the earliest ones, a bit earlier.
1945.
1945. They got a medical past that. And anyway, there's blokes there, there's sergeants, warrant officers and all that, that you didn't know the names. And there was a bloke, Milburn, Sergeant Milburn. He was on the staff there. He was a lot older than me. He'd been too old for the war, but he was down all the fishing work. And he talked to me for an hour. He said, well, I didn't take your demob, man. He says, he was a South Country bloke. He said, don't take your demob, man. He says, you've done the hard part. He says, you've got the rank of sergeant. He says, it's finished as far as you're concerned. He says, if something else happened, he said, they won't send you. He said, how old are you now? I said, I'm 29, 29 and a half. Well, he says, you've done yours. He said, all you'll go, go back to your depot. He says, you'll get promotion again, you know, if you want at no time. He says, your war service will count. He says, war service counts double. He said, no bloody time at all. He says, you'll have 21 years in. And he was right, you know, with me territorial service, war service, it was 18 years. I'd had 3 years to do, and I'd had 21 years in. I'd had a bloody good pension, and I could have even stopped on after that if I'd wanted. But now I would have signed on like that. But I mean, let's be fair, like, it's been 6 years there. Your mind was in a whirl, so I took the lot out.
What was the demob procedure that you went through?
We got on a train, Norfolk, and Pete ran out, it's all flat country, isn't it? Monotonous really country. I had to get demobbed at Northampton, you see. So, oh, a lot was on the train, there was a train to stop me, other blokes jumping on, they were gone. The one and only time I've been to Peterborough, off in the station, trucks took us up to this demob centre. You had to walk back by because you're finished. I like that bit in, see. And it was just like joining the bloody army, I suppose, when lads was called from the war. You went in, there's all the clothes in there, you've got a trilby hat, you've got a mac, come overcoat, you know, you got a suit, 2 shirts, and I said the trilby hat, you got the socks, and this, that, and the other. And you got them. It took your time, like, you know, you try them on, and this, that, and the other, pick your own colour in raisin, and this, that, and the other, and then you moved down, went another way, went in there, and you signed your papers and this, that, and the other. Well, this was all in boxes, you know, they put them in boxes, you didn't want stuff and all that. They're easy to carry. And there was a corporal, starting horse corporal behind the desk there. You had all the other gear, buy arms and ammunition, you know. I say, we'd got new battle dresses when we come back, like, and they were quite clean and such as that. You had your greatcoat. Should leave your greatcoat over there. I says, you what? You should leave your greatcoat over there. He says, not allowed to take it. I says, you're fucking kidding, aren't you? I says, I shoved them 2 stripes straight down your throat. And I've just done 6 years. This greatcoat's been with me all over, hadn't I, you know? I says, there's no book of getting that. But anybody definitely leave the greatcoat, they left it. But most of them had them, mind, going out. And you'd got your warrants before you left your camp, like your travel warrants. onto the train and feet, I got her. Got home.
Did De Morbihan finishing with him, did that settle you down a bit easier after that?
Well, it was like another change in the weather, mentally and physically like. You didn't realise you were civvy till then, you know. And it was hard, you know. Like, you were back, you were in the civvy straight, but so obviously you want to slow them, like. You know, so just, dear me, how. And then, the bottom dropped out the world, you knew you weren't working for the government anymore. You had to make your own way in life. You see, you had either sign on the door or get a job, you know. I didn't have any trade like millions of others, I didn't have a trade. So, my father had been, he was alive then, he'd been a mine, he'd been this, been all that, and he'd worked a lot of years at the gas company, it was gas company then, you know. And there was, he said, the job down there if you wanted. He said, I've seen Watson, the manager. So I started, I worked there about 12 months. And, the wages was low and all that, you know. So, as a kid, I'd had some mining experience, so I told the wife, I decided to go to the mines for 4 or 5 years, make some money, but I didn't intend to spend my life in there, like. So I did, and I went to Bova and Corrie over here. I got set on, I was setting you on straight away, and I was drilling there, like, and I lost down to a finger and a half there. Aye.
How was that?
Right. Drilling on the wall, and you know pit work, you know mining, yeah.
A little.
You know the stone structure and such as that. Get the what they call cat arses in, don't you? You know, they're like fossilised tree trunks. There's some that big, some all, they'll kill you, they're that big. You've got to watch for them. You see them, put a prop under, you know, and they're real, they're more like a glass than a stone, they weigh like bloody lead. And they are fossilised tree trunks dating back from the days when the earth formed itself. And right round there was a thin coat of coal, maybe about a quarter of an inch. That was, we told, was the original bark. So the lightest, the slightest vibration, they dropped out. Well, the bugger dropped out on me fingers. It wasn't a big one, mine. Took them off. But I went back to the pit for a while, like, and then I went on stone drilling after that. And I thought, this is no race, no road, no job for Jackson for the rest of his life. So. There was a factory opened up here, Dardham's, you know, engineering factory. They were setting them on anybody. A lot of trading will come from the way here. They couldn't get the trading around here, you know. So I went up there. Haynes was the manager. And I said, I'm looking for a job. He said, what are you? I said, oh, I want a job as a labourer. He said, what are you doing now? I said, I'm a driller in the coal mines. Oh, yes. When can you start? I says, next Monday, now if you like. She said, start next Monday. She said, right. So I went in the next Monday, and I was about a load of dozen starting. How are you? I'm so-and-so. What are you? Sheet metal worker. Go over there, ask for so-and-so. What are you? Plater, welders, and that. Labourer, you go then. He comes to me, he says, what are you? I says, a labourer. He said, where were you working now? He said, I remember your face. I said, I've been a driller in the coal mines. He said, I'll make you a driller here. I just started to laugh. So what are you laughing at? Well, I says, no relationship between the jobs. I said, work-wise, mind. I said, no problem. But he, can you sharpen a drill? I said, I can sharpen drills. I said, sharpen any drill you've got here, because coal drills is about 8 different settings, you know. He says, there's a lot of hand drilling here. He says, go and see, ask for Cooper, a little fella called Cooper. He says, he's sick of the job. He says, spend a week with him. He said, you're the hand driller. And it worked out of that. It was a busy job, mind, but you got all the overtime you wanted, see? And I finished up with overtime, as much money as I made in the pits, like. And then as years went on, I did various jobs, and I started a piecework system. Went on for about 18 months, made some money at that. They got on to making road tankers, all shapes, all sizes, you know. And all you see in the shape of road tankers, oval, like, you know. And there's not only the two panels or baffles that we call on the end, the inside as well. There might be 5 compartments, 6 compartments, 4 compartments. Well, each tank had a number of baffles. Well, you've got the job making a table for them, the right size, you know. And these plates were cut and they were pressed on a big press, like a half circle. And I got a lad with me, a good worker, and we strapped them down. There's 2 straps. You strap them, even them out, and you had a big hammer, and you braid them over cold, put a flange on them right round. It's hard work, mine, but when you prime your life, you know, and you got broke into it, don't you? And what a good way to pay for it. Piece work we made. We make money, make a lot of money than the tradesmen. Some of the British tradesmen were. They called themselves tradesmen, some of them I think they were bluffing. But we did all right till the piece work finished. And then after that, we dropped down onto a basic rate. And I thought, I'm just looking my guts out underneath baffles for that. And anyway, there was a crane slinger's job went vacant. It's a busy job, mind. You get a minute, but I went crane slinging, and there was a mobile crane. It was very busy. But I went on. If the crane driver's off, you had to drive the crane. You got a bit of practice. It was a dodgy job, but you weren't long mastering it. And I fancy the crane driver, well, that had a bloody heart attack. He died, so I got the last 5 years I was a crane driver. And then at that time, the wife's health was failing. And we used to get out one thing or another, but she, you know. And I was just on 60 year old, and I got the chance of redundancy. And I knew it wasn't down about, I got £2,500, which it's now, it wasn't bad then. But I got a pension for these, of the coal bed. Wasn't a big one, but it kept you out above the water, you know. Anyway, I got a chance of redundancy at 60 year old, and I took it. So I was actually 72. I'm 78, and when the wife died, I was 72, so we had 12 years together. And I know other daughters there, but they had the families. I was doing 95% of everything. But a good heart, like, I was enjoying it. And she wasn't that ill, she couldn't get out, you know. But I was taking the burden, like, I didn't want a medal for it, it was my duty, and I'd be at home where it was good enough, like. And then I was having a lot of trouble with, between you and I, this mind, I was having a lot of trouble with my hearing, you know. And it actually started when I got hit in Marath. I went deaf for a few days, you know. And it was never the same. And shortly after, I'd run back to you, and as you know, I got took prisoner on Sicily, like, hadn't been able to do nothing about it. So I went to see the doctor. He's retired now, Dr. Stoker, on the bank. He said, "Where your ears is clear, there's no waxing out." He said, "There's obviously some damage to your ears." He said, "I'll send you to Dryburn, I'll send a letter." He said, "Give it a week or two." He said, "You get a letter, go up and get a hearing aid." And I've had one since, so a lot of years ago. It's the third one I've had, like, and they give us the strongest one they could give us the last time. So I'm studying this up. So the one about blokes impaired hearing getting pensioned, I thought, "Why, it's a very good life." And the one about you filled a form in with Social Security and took a long time. So what I did, I was talking to a bloke, I said, "Oh, bugger this." And I wasn't in the British Legion, mind, but this bloke used to give us the pamphlet, the little magazines come on periodically. I used to read them through, they're interesting. And I was reading this, and it said, "Anybody suffering from any after effects of the Second World War, whatever it is, if it's a genuine case, you do not need to be a member of the British Legion. Inform us and we'll help you." So here I wrote in, explained, like, well, they send you the form back like that. When you joined up, regimental number, where you served, you know, and you have to write everything down. And they check with the War Office through your records to see if you're not telling lies. Well, then they sent us another one back for the Social Security. And they said, "We've went through your records, and they're impeccable, like, meaning you hadn't told lies, like. And we advise you to follow this case through. Fill this in, send it to your, take it to your native Social Security office, hand it in, and it'll take some time, take a few weeks, but if you haven't heard anything within 3 months, let us know." You say, "Well, I did, eh, like." And then I wrote them back and told them, and then I got another letter, and they said, "Why, follow your case through. And if there's any point, the point where they're going to refuse you, we'll supply a solicitor. It'll cost you nothing." We didn't come to that, like. I went to two audiologists. I went to one at Sunderland. And he'd went through it, like. And anyway, you'll know the audiology business. You kind of tell a lie. You have a little bloody box there. And you kind of win, mind. Anybody going there not telling the truth, you know. So I said, how long I'd had an hearing aid and this, that and the other. And he said, what are you claiming on? I said, I'm claiming on my war service, actually, that's when it started. And he's writing it all down. I said, the British Legion have all this, mind. I said, and Social Security. Well, he said, I've got to write it down. He's asking us about the infantry work, what the noise effect was and what weapons was used and all this. It was a bloody hour and a half, brought it down. And then I got my hearing tested and I'd have to say eh, all the bloody time, you know. I wasn't kidding about it, you know that, I think. Anyway, I got through the test and I come out, he says, actually, he says, you've lost 73% of your hearing. He says, in some cases, we'll do a little operation. He says, in your case, I don't think it's possible. And that was when I got the second hearing aid. He said, I'll write a letter to driver. He said, he lives up Whitesmock somewhere. He said, I live at Whitesmock. So I'll send a letter to driver. He said, give him a fortnight. He said, go up. He said, you'll get a stronger hearing aid. See? And then I did that. And in the meantime, the case was going through. And they decided to double check, I think. So they sent us to, what the hell they call the roads? It's on the road to Gosford, the other side of Newcastle. Had to find this bloke. He's a coloured bloke, like an Indian type, but he was alright, he was just a shame. And had to get the interview. There was a Scots lass first, take all your details. I said, I've done this 4 times, but she said, alright. She said, we've got to do it. I said, the back check, you know. And she said, anyway, she said, why have you just come now? I said, you know, it's kind of a few years ago. I said, why? Tell the truth to you and I. I said, I heard them talking about you could get a pension for impaired hearing. I said, would? Oh, yes, she said, common sense. She says, you know, we've had hundreds of you. She said, get away. And she says, most of them, do you know what they were? She said, the National Service. She said, they'd never heard a gun fired. She said, what they've claimed in. She said, well, they did, I don't know, mine. But anyway, I saw the bloke and he told me the same. And he said, oh, you've lost over 70% of your hearing. He said, it'll get no better. He says, and I don't think you'll have to come back here again. But he says, if you have, just come back, meaning for the double check. The next thing I heard from, not many weeks later, I heard from Social Security, some Adelaide's was it, and the reward is 40%.
So you get a pension for that?
I get a pension for that, aye. Well, I was a genuine case, man, you know. But my hearing's hard, very bad. I mean, I've got this, like, you know, but sometimes even you talk, and it's even with that. If I'm in a club and there's background noise, it's a waste of time. But for television on your own, or if I'm out the back, I can hear the birds whistling, you know. See? That's my life story, it's about all to it.